And I'm going to try and convince you all that stents help patients with disabling iliac and obstructive PTS, and we want to figure this out. So why do we need a randomized controlled trial? I know the interventionists will be on my side, but we'll try and convince them that interventionists will figure this as well. So I'm going to try and project what my esteemed opponent is going to say. The available data are limited. Bias is uncontrolled and unblinded, and they all have a small sample size. And that's led to the overall lack of consensus that we have regarding the treatment of this disease. The procedure is not without risks. Certainly you can get venous injury, but you can get arterial injury as well. The stents can misbehave. Migration, occlusion, stenosis, or some other malfunction. These patients can develop acute DVT after treatment, and then you can develop injuries to the surrounding structures as well, including nerve injuries and paresthesias. And a convincing argument, one that I happen to agree with, is that most patients do not avail themselves of best supportive therapy, and their providers are not proactive in this regard. So we have poor stocking compliance. That's certainly known, SOX trial, others, that patients just don't wear what we ask them to wear, and they don't do a good job of it, and we're certainly to blame on that as well. That wound care is sporadic or absent in many cases. And when there are venoactive drugs available to these patients, there's very limited compliance. So we're just not doing a good job with the so-called cheap stuff to do instead of just jumping into a stent. But then you get a patient like this, and this patient has ulcer for about 20 years. When we see something like this, are we convinced that the best supportive therapy is going to be enough to take care of this patient who's been suffering for a long time? Stents work. How can restoration of flow and resolving obstruction be a bad thing? Sure, there's no randomized controlled data, but what's there is compelling. And this is one of the early studies, from 2007 from Glenn and Raju, and of nearly 1,000 patients, about half of them were in post-thrombotic wounds. They saw pain reduction, they saw reduction in severe swelling, of about 68%, and importantly, they saw ulcer healing as well. So we know that these patients get better. Now, of course, it's not randomized, probably biased, but we did see patients get better. Stents work in other ways too. And sure, these procedures carry inherent risk, but it is an occluded vein. So how are you going to hurt something that's already blocked? Crossing through a vein that's blocked, it's not going to bleed because there's no blood going through it. Can you really make it that much worse? And then you have these powerful patient testimonials. And for those of you that do these procedures or care for these patients, you've heard them. That wound closed and stayed closed for the first 10 years. I can now walk my dog pain-free. I can play tennis for the first time in 10 years. I've lost 30 pounds because I can actually exercise. Whereas before, my leg hurt from just going up the stairs. We've also been hampered by non-disease specific tools. Off-label usage of stents has been the rule for several decades, as Suresh alluded to earlier. We had self-expanding Eljoy and Nightmal stents, and because the design was not disease specific, it required a lot of experience and it was difficult to place these accurately. They suffered from foreshortening, they had limited radial force or crush resistance, and we just found ourselves placing many stents. You can never quite predict, particularly with one type of stent, how long it was going to be. So what might take one stent ended up taking three stents. There's a cost to that, and you're additionally adding areas for mechanical failure. For Nightmal stents, there was a trade-off for the appropriate diameter. They used to only go up to 14 millimeters, and so certainly that's sometimes just not enough. And with the Eljoy stents, we just really didn't know what the final diameter was going to be. What it said on the box was not necessarily what it ended up as, because it's a function of the deployed length of the stent. But now we have disease-specific tools, at least for almost a year now. On-label stents have been prospectively evaluated in industry trials, but well-run at industry trials. The two-year Vertus and vernacular data has shown a primary patency around 73 to 75%, which is on the higher end of the historical data. These are the two independently conducted trials. So the historical data is 60 to 80%, and now we have two trials that show us getting close to 80%. That's promising. We have more devices on the way, and we have better crush resistance with reliability in deployment, predictable diameters, and longer stent lengths. So I'm now going to show you a bunch of cases that show what happened with what we used to have and how we can now avoid it with our new devices. So this is a patient that it looked okay when it was placed. I don't have those images. It was placed at an outside hospital, and then the stent foreshortened and it became occluded. Now with better deployment accuracy, we can avoid it. So we had to go through this patient, cross it, and then place a new novel on-label venous stent, and it's still open now several months later. This is a patient that has a complex iliofemoral occlusion involving the common femoral vein. The profunda is pretty good, but it involved the common femoral vein all the way through the iliac vein. And with our older stents, this would have required at least two stents, if not three, maybe four, depending on how it ended up deploying. But we were able to do this patient with two stents, so one long stent for the entire iliac segment, and then a second stent for the common femoral segment, and you get a great outcome, and this patient is still patent and is now doing all the things that she wasn't able to do for years. Not only do you use less stents, and that's an important economic benefit, but you also introduce less points for mechanical failure by only having one stent joint instead of three. And finally, this is a picture that many of us have seen. The stent is crushed. This is a well-placed stent. It's in the right position, but it's crushed, and this patient started developing venous claudication symptoms again, as you can see on the image on the right, lower right, that there's some thrombus or organized material that's developed inside of that stent. So with the new stents, we have improved crush resistance. So in this patient, we crossed. The IVUS on the right shows that the compression site has reared its ugly head again, and the stent is compressed. And because of that compression, you have this organized material within the stent and a compromised lumen. Once we get through, we place a new stent in, the compression site is now resolved, and you can see on this follow-up imaging that you no longer have the crush of the stent. The stent is completely open, this patient's symptoms have improved altogether. So in conclusion, I think the existing data is pretty good. There's certainly more to come with disease-specific devices, which is unlike anything we've had before in this space. And like anything, the procedure is relatively safe in experienced hands. There are risks, but if we do a lot, if you send it to a provider that does a lot of these procedures, the procedure is relatively safe. Certainly needs to be studied further, but what we have in the IDE trial data for these new stents is encouraging. We also agree that we need to improve non-procedural care of these patients, but do we need to stop offering patients in a randomized trial what we know works just to prove that we need to get better at the non-procedural care of these patients? Thanks.
Super Monday and experience matters. Aren't you about the same age as Mayor Pete? We all know how that turned out.
She's not ready.
It's time to lie. So I didn't pick the title, by the way, but I am here to actually let you know that medical conservative therapy is the way to go. So iliofemoral DVT, all of you have heard this. Bad things happen, 95% get chronic venous insufficiency, 15% get ulcers, it costs the US economy billions of dollars. But if you actually look at this trial from Kogo in the 70s, only 8% of all DVT actually represents iliofemoral DVT isolated. And so this is a problem that maybe not as widespread as we think. And you'll tell me all the pictures you've seen this morning look like this: terrible wounds and lipodermatosclerosis and hyperpigmentation, but really 95% of people that we see look like this. Maybe a little bit of swelling, maybe some varicose veins, and do we really want to subject our patients to stents, which we don't know a lot about right now? One of the things I do want you to keep in mind in all seriousness is that the physiological mechanisms of post-traumatic syndrome are well elucidated. But as we go through these medical therapies, I want you to think about which one of these therapies actually address these physiological mechanisms, including recurrent DVT, venous valve dysfunction, saphenous vein reflux, that we know results in increased ambulatory pressure, which we think is the etiology of these bad things that happen. And so I'm going to try to highlight that as we go through. So one of the problems we have in looking at this is we don't have a good physiological measure of outflow obstruction. We don't think venous reflux time is that great. And actually, I'm happy Dr. Marston's group is here and Bill is here and did this work with Aeropleth. And I know Aeropleth has a bad rap, but it's the only thing we have right now that would actually quantitate volume and outflow obstruction at the physiological level. And it's been shown that venous filling index is actually a fairly reliable measure of outflow obstruction. So here's a patient from our lab that clearly on duplex has iliac vein obstruction. This patient had a Valalta of 10 and a VCSS of 9, and therefore would have been eligible for the CTRAC trial. But if you look at the venous filling index on the right index leg, it was actually considered normal. So this patient was clearly using collateral flow and had a normal BFI. So the guidelines for medical therapy that we have, and I'm glad Dr. Khan is in the front row, she should be giving this to me. They come from her publication in American Heart, which is about 4 years old now, and I'm sure there are updates to this. And so let's go through each one of these medical therapies and see what the data shows. So first of all, compression. We've talked a lot about compression, and we have, this is a study from more than 20 years ago now that shows compression with about 80% compliance, treats the signs and symptoms of post-thrombotic syndrome very effectively and has longevity. In fact, it was statistically better at 16 months. But there's still nuances to compression that we're learning about. For example, this small study of 16 patients looked at thigh-high versus knee-high compression. Typically, we look at knee-high and found that thigh-high was actually better at reducing volume and swelling. This isn't something that I've really incorporated selectively into my practice. And so we're still even learning about what the best compression looks like. What about different devices? Again, Dr. Khan looked at this VenaWave, and although this isn't something that's widely available, it did improve quality of life and decrease the Valalta score. So there's different techniques that we can use. Well, what about the inflammatory markers that I talked to you about? Does compression treat that? And there is data that shows, this was a study of venous ulcer patients that had compression, and even at 4 weeks, it shows statistically less inflammatory markers and less inflammatory markers with pro-cytokines. And so we know that this compression is actually addressing the underlying physiology of post-thrombotic syndrome. The other thing that's been highlighted, and you'll see this at every venous meeting, is that we're learning more about the swelling and the pain of post-thrombotic syndrome, and we now are recognizing that these patients have lymphatic impairment. And this has introduced a whole other group of treatments that we can give our patients that were never available to us before. And I'll be talking a little bit more about this afternoon. In fact, there is a study published in Vascular Medicine that looked at adding lymphedema treatment to post-thrombotic care, and it was most beneficial in those with moderate to severe post-thrombotic syndrome. So this introduces another level of therapy that we didn't know that was available to us. And so the guideline says in patients with post-thrombotic syndrome due compression. Well, what about these herbal products that Dr. Desai referred to? Unfortunately, we just don't have an FDA source, but these are widely available in Europe, and these are all anti-inflammatories. Now, in Dr. Khan's review, defibrotide was statistically significantly less edema and pain, and we do have an FDA-approved source of defibrotide. It's for hepatic varices. But there are Cochrane systematic reviews that showed ASN, horse chestnut seed, flavonoids can in the short term reduce pain and swelling. So this is an option as you get more familiar with using these drugs, there is some efficacy. Again, Dr. Khan looked at exercise, something that we should promote for all of our cardiovascular patients. Not only was this feasible during a 6-month trial, it also improved our important outcomes of quality of life and the Valalta. And the other thing that is on the horizon is we're learning more about the medicines that we treat DVT with long-term. So in this study of patients who had chronic venous ulcers, the worst of the worst, who were randomized to low-dose nadriparin, low molecular weight heparin, versus standard compression therapy for 12 months, they had statistically less ulcers, meaning higher healing in the nadriparin group, 80 versus 60%. And very importantly, the group that had the most benefit were the elderly. And the elderly here, look at this, 91 versus 27% are the ones we know we often exclude from these trials. So this represents a treatment for them. What's now exciting and coming out is we're now learning about what DOACs do. And I think this is the new frontier. So this is a post analysis of a database. And it looked at patients treated for DVT with Riva versus warfarin and found a 23% reduction in post-thrombotic syndrome. This finding has actually now been replicated. I just checked my weekly NHLBI that I get every Monday, and there's a prospective study that was published in Surgery that has now prospectively also shown that patients who were treated with rivaroxaban have less post-thrombotic syndrome versus those treated with warfarin. So this is the new frontier in terms of our medical therapy. We also know about the EFRA trial in patients who had, a large proportion had DVT, who had early saphenous ablation only, were able to heal their ulcer. So maybe we can look to the deep collaterals and ablate the saphenous vein and have healing without having to put the stent into the iliac vein. Dr. Van Dantham shared these data with me in his secondary analysis. Even from the ATTRACT trial, we see that there was a very modest improvement in quality of life in our patients, mostly in the severe patients. But importantly, it did not reduce recurrent DVT or valvular reflux. And so these are important outcomes that are not addressed. And again, he shared with me this the comparison between the ultrasound-guided Dutch cavus study, which showed, again, no statistical difference in post-thrombotic syndrome, the open vein therapy up front, and they did not find an improvement in the moderate to severe group. So as you know, Dr. Desai said, we have questions about stents. What is the longevity? We know right now the patency is only 60 to 80%. We do not know what to do with anticoagulation, even short-term or long-term with these. I've had a few women that are of childbearing age, and they are just not interested. I think it's very risky to stent someone who is still having children. We just don't know the durability of the clinical benefit. So I would say to you, if you look at our outcomes in this study, quality of life and symptoms, as well as underlying physiological mechanisms, that medical therapy improves pain, swelling, inflammation, and as well as can heal ulcers and improve quality of life with very little risk. So unfortunately, Dr. Desai, your stents are going to suffer the fate of Tickle Me Elmo.
As we can see, there are different ways to manage PTS, and I think that many of us who are endovascular physicians probably agree that